Good morning. Welcome back to the Edge and Flow podcast. This is TJ Schwartz. I'm here with Lucas Burnley, and we're going to talk more about knives, knife shows, knife making, and art and design, business, and I'm sure some other things are going to come in. I don't know
I think
what
the
yet.
list is getting bigger,
Yeah, I know.
which seems to be true for lists in general. I am finding that my lists are not necessarily getting shorter.
Yeah,
So,
that's a fact.
where should we start, man? This we haven't, so we missed a week. You did Blade Show. I have had kind of a crazy couple of weeks. Should we just start with Blade?
If
Or
you
should we
want,
start with shop updates?
let's start with shop updates. Let's hear what you've been doing because you've been doing shop stuff.
Oh man, this has been a crazy month, last month. I'm jumping back and forth between production and design, which is it's been a smoother transition. A lot of times I kind of like I'll get into a flow and I can't break it. Out of necessity, I think that I have it's started to adapt. And then I've had I think three machines go down, which
Whoa.
is yeah,
Whoa.
I'll yeah, let's just start there. Machines that went down. This is since I started the Kihoku project, I've been like sending you messages and being like, man, the efficiency or like method of working brings out or shows a lot of flaws in other systems. So if all of a sudden you have something that is running either more numbers or I guess it's pretty much we could tie it to more numbers, it's going to be more prone to showing you like the weak links in a system. Okay. Normally when I surface grind, I'm surface grinding, I don't know, five pieces or something, folder blades, something like that. It turns out somehow the VFD I set up for my surface grinder was underrated for the horsepower of the motor. Okay. So what that meant was I could surface grind a few pieces. When I try to do more, it basically overloads the motor or overloads the control. Like I don't know from an electrical side, but all of a sudden my surface grinder was shutting down. And I lost my mind. Could not figure out what was going on. I assumed like, oh, the 1950s surface grinder is like the motor is burning out because I'm using like a modern VFD on it. Luckily, we have a really cool like electric dedicated electric motor shop here. And the dude is really nice and really patient and has come by my shop a few times. I let him know what was going on. He like came through, checked it out, and diagnosed that. So I now have a new VFD. I will set that up. Same, like it's just like these little things where you're like, it's just enough problem solving to be really frustrating in the moment. The same time that happened, my recirculation pump for my tramp skinner on my mill went out. And so it runs on a timer. I come and I look one day and I hadn't run the mill in like probably 2 weeks or something. My coolant is just trashed. Just like a thick layer of tramp oil on it, residue buildup, and waited for a tramp oil pump. And it's like that kind of stuff when you're like everything was flowing. I was working on Kihoku's. Things are like going pretty smooth. I'm getting ready to start the next round. And then it's like two machines out. So
That's a frustration right there for sure. I get that.
it's just the it's like it the numbers thing is really interesting because it's like a systems test, right? Trying to think what else. I got to see Jens and so friend of the pod after Blade Show. It was really nice, kind of a just a nice like work adjacent break.
Yeah.
got to go to the shooting range, got to go see our buddy Keaton, like just got a lot of talks. This is tied to the efficiency thing in like a really roundabout way. While he was here, I had like an epiphany around something you and I have talked about, which is that efficiency inside of a small creative shop actually poses kind of a problem, right? Which is a lot of my shop is still like funky custom knife maker shop, where you open a drawer and you find a bunch of random handle materials, one-off prototype hardware, like things that for me are really, they're at one point were very necessary. At this point, they're still feel like a part of what I do. But in the context of like doing like the Kihoku, they're not necessary and they're taking up space. So what I decided to do is I'm going to move all that stuff into my design studio almost as like a material library, but kind of visual.
Yeah, that's
And
cool.
that seems like a really good application
I like that.
where you like kind of see it like, oh, I've got like these funky micartas or woods or whatever it is, where when I'm designing, I actually have like a visual reference for certain
It's a
thought
palette.
processes. Exactly. It's like a knife maker color wheel almost. And
That's
that
cool. I like
is
that idea.
kind of fun, right? Because then I get to keep like the funky stuff, or like a, I've got like a big chunk of wagon wheel, like, a foot of wagon wheel, wrought iron. It's not being used in the day to day, but if I remembered that I have it, that's the kind of thing that like sparks like a one-off like custom project. So yeah.
No, I like that. I'm gonna have to.
That was pretty good. And then I guess last shop update, we like tied together, still doing crazy social media push. That is working. Metric standpoint, I want to say we're closing on like 3 million views somewhere in there over the last 6 weeks, 2.5 million, something like that. 5,000 net gain of followers.
That's a lot, dude. That's
Right
huge.
now, it feels huge. And we're kind of like pushing into this next month and seeing like where it goes. But we did like the TM Dao like shop kind of tour stuff. It's so interesting seeing how content gets like pushed up or down, and then like those videos got lower views than other videos. Doesn't matter. Like, I'm really glad we did it. And that whole point was to like tell a little bit of a story and hopefully help Jeff like, sell some of the stuff from his dad's shop. But it's wild to just see, like, this is such a complicated game right now. As like a group of people who are just trying to make things for a living, but then having to film it. But then the way that you film it is not the right way to have that be successful. It is frustrating. So, like, if anybody is listening and you're like really, really down on social media, it's warranted. I still think there's a way through it, and I think that there's a lot of value in it, but it's not an easy landscape right now.
No, that's a fact. No, you guys are doing great work. It's
Thanks.
I'm enjoying the content.
The feedback's been awesome, man, and I think it is warming up, essentially. I don't know what it's warming up to, but it does feel like it's starting to make some minor shifts, and just seeing like conversations starting and like visibility changing. Other than that, the design side, super proud of myself. I have submitted three new production designs. I'm hitting a point with Fusion where I'm starting to truly feel like it's making knives, which is crazy.
That is awesome.
Like, I'm not searching for solutions as much. I'm not struggling with the things that were really tripping me up early on were like around constraints and organization, and that stuff seems to be starting to click.
Yeah, you've been sending me your progress, man. It's It's a superpower. It really is.
It feels, it literally feels like magic.
There's almost nothing more valuable to someone in our position in a way. You know, it's like the ability to just imagine and create in that way. It's the future for sure. I don't know.
It, no, I had never felt, I had never felt like when I was doing CAD that I was making. And I think the, it's a, that's a weird thing. Like I think I've talked about this before, which is like, I used to schedule design time outside of what I consider my working hours because I couldn't reconcile it as work, which is the most ridiculous statement, but it's the way that my brain processed it. Now it's satisfying the creative, it's sat or a creative drive that would be very similar to me going downstairs, grabbing a bar of steel and just kind of like winging it into a new design because I of the flexibility and the ability to iterate on a feature or thought. It is crazy. Kind of feel like you're a psychedelic shaman and you're like, yeah, I'm like, whoa, that's crazy. And you're like, yeah, it is crazy. Because it does, it's like door opening. You know?
You're like it's a projection of your mind onto a screen in a 3D world. It's
And then you can 3D print it.
yeah, exactly. And that's what I've told a lot of people is a lot of people struggle with CAD and they get frustrated, which I
Yeah.
remember that. I remember hating CAD. And it's like there's a that threshold where it becomes like an addiction thing. It's like a pretty fine line where you go from fighting it to using it, and then all of a sudden it's this hyper, it's almost like a video game, but way more productive and
Exactly.
important than that.
That's kind of what it feels like. And it's hard. It's hard now kind of separating. So I've been doing, I've tracked kind of the flow. I used to sketch every morning and I'm still sketching. But what I realized it's turning into is I basically do 2 hours worth of design almost every morning.
Nice.
I think over the course of a year, that with Fusion is going to be productive in a very different, like a different
Yeah.
way.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
So yeah, that is basically, those are my shop updates. Kihoku's, CAD, and Broken Machines.
So you said you had three machines down. Did I miss the third one?
I might have, what was the third one? My coolant pump on my surface grinder also stopped functioning. So that one was like kind of, that was almost like a, not a side effect, but it wouldn't have normally been a problem, except I thought maybe, oh, my surface grinder, because it's running a belt, it's putting a lot more torque into the spindle. Let me try a stone. I'll run my stone with coolant. Coolant pump was out.
Oh, dang. That was going to
So,
be my next question when you said coolant pump, is that you're not running coolant with the belt? Is that correct?
not running coolant with
Yeah,
the belt.
I was going to say that would be, I thought I
So,
was.
okay. So, if you're listening, I give you, and you're not familiar with this. So, surface grinder is a big machine that makes things flat, basically, right? So, like if you think about a blade blank, it is traveling X and Y to surface and then Z travel down to remove material. In industry, they use a wheel, right? A grinding wheel, different substrates, different grits. Super, super precise, but slow, especially on these older machines where you're feeding things manually, or you maybe have just a an XY cross feed. Knife makers have over the years converted these machines to run a 2x72 belt like our blade grinders. You lose a little bit of accuracy, but you gain a huge amount of speed. And for the parts that we're running, I mean, it's staying within tolerance, like it's staying within, I would say, a thousandth across the entire length, A lot of times, probably even less than that.
That's good.
And it works great. So, I mean, and it's probably a margin of like, it's probably three or four times faster, maybe even more than that.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Just goes to show like the like what you guys are doing. Like you guys are surface grinding. You're surface grinding huge batches and you have, it's an automatic downfeed, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So that is the better solution when you're dealing with a lot of the same parts. So this is definitely, I feel like, a solution for custom knife makers or small batch where you have a lot of variability in what you're making. Your solution is much better for a product line.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, the belt thing is always kind of, I've been intrigued about the belt thing. That's why I asked. Yeah. I was like, wait, you're running coolant with a belt? Like,
yeah,
I think, you know what's funny, leather.
I mean, theoretically, there are wet belts. You could do it, but you just don't need it. And nice. It's pretty interesting too. Like a lot of knife makers will use a surface grinder with a belt conversion to do things like cut pins to length. If you don't have a lathe, you make a plate and you put holes in it and you drop your pins in it. And then you use that to do it. Or you can do the same with a mill. You can use carpet tape. And if you're running a belt, you can grind handle material down to thickness or non-ferrous metals that aren't magnetized. Mm-hmm. Like there's so much flexibility around kind of what it can do. It's pretty interesting.
That's handy.
Yeah. Well, you know, a kind of a product plug is I have one of the Wurtz grinders. When I bought it with the surface grinding attachment. It's been sitting on my shop wall since I bought it, but I liked the concept of like turning a 2x72 grinder into a surface grinder, realizing the accuracy would not be the same. While my machine was down, I was like, not knowing what's going on. I'm like, I have to be able to surface grind if I need to. So I set it up. It was surprisingly accurate. And it's basically a hand controlled cross feed across a 2x72 grinder surface, you know, like wheel. It would totally work and it was fast. It's just so counterintuitive to be like, let me dial this in and pull it across by hand.
Yeah.
But for fixed blades, I mean, even for folders, I think the accuracy's there.
I've wanted one of those for a long time. I've got the TW90 and
it's just kind of cool.
I've looked at it almost every time I go to Blade Show in Atlanta, I go look at that thing. And because he's updated it over the years.
Yeah. I can't cool. say like for you, it's necessary. I was doing like a shop audit. I was getting ready to sell it. I couldn't bring myself to sell it because I was like, it's too fast and kind of valuable in the right situation.
Well, it's a almost infallible backup because
exactly
those things can't really fail per se.
It's pretty hard. I mean,
it's not really gonna, if it did fail, you could fix it with hand tools, you know?
I mean, there's just nothing there.
It's not electronic or anything. Not,
yeah. Yeah. There's no motor even. As long as you have a grinder running, you have it. The other thing is I was thinking like as we push into this slightly more kind of efficient frontier, I still want the areas where I can be really like flaky artist creative. If I have an employee and the employee needs to run parts on the service grinder and I've decided that I want to make a billet of Damascus, this is a way for me to like surface grind that billet.
Yeah. Well, and I've seen people use them with a small wheel perpendicular as opposed to parallel. And they'll do like enormous fullers in like some short sword or something like that.
Totally. And that right there, you're like, that's an efficiency. Dude, knife making, I don't know what I would like to know other industries that have the same level of problem solving. I just saw on Facebook, I saw a maker using his mill and a small magnetic chuck with a CBN wheel. Okay. To essentially, it's like disc grinding, but surface grinding folder parts. And he's making slip joints. And is it an a proper application of like anything in that system. I mean, the chuck, maybe the grinding wheel, definitely not the mill. But you look and you're like, that is a super elegant solution for a small shop making slip joints that doesn't have room for a surface grinder.
Yes, yeah. And
You're like, that just works.
that's where we end up in this industry is if you want a shop to do it all, and like certain knife designs and approaches to knives can involve massive arrays of equipment, whereas like if you're a one-man shop, you're not going to have like a gigantic machine shop. You're going to have to figure out how to multi-tool all your stuff. And so I love seeing that.
I wonder if the nature of knife making will change. This is probably a foregone conclusion and true of any industry. So I went to TM Dowell shop and I look around, and what I see is a timeline that is very familiar to me because of my mentors, right? So like Joe Cordova's shop looked the same in many ways. Smelled the same because the processes that were happening were essentially the same.
Because everything had a quarter inch of micarta on it.
Oh yeah, and wood, and like was made
Yeah.
out of industrial parts that might have come from like some other machine shop,
Yeah.
and
Yeah.
the leather, and you know, it's just like it's so familiar. Bob T's shop is multiple generations past that, but has the same like feel, right? And it's like silly things like the workbenches, where you're like, you guys made them out of wood, and you kind of made them the same way, and they have the same amount of wear and like gun oil, and you have a piece of carpet sitting on top as like a, you know, like an assembly pad, and it's just like this very familiar kind of, I don't know, environment. I think that my shop doesn't feel like that. Your shop doesn't feel like that. So I think that generationally, as new makers come in, the way of shop kind of and the view is it will change.
Yeah.
I guess it's not sad, but there it's like you this is the idea of like aging into an industry and seeing like the way of the industry change and the nature of the industry change.
Yeah, and it reminds me like at Maker Syndicate, it's the Maker Syndicate, so it's a bunch of knife makers. That's all
Yeah.
that's really there. And so it's like a decent cross section of like the state of affairs in the industry. And
Yeah.
so when you're talking shop, it's like a lot of similarities that are totally different than what you're describing, which is like, the
Totally.
25 plus years ago. I mean, it's basically like what CNC mill are you running? And it's like, well, I've got, this. It's basically pretty much everyone there was running a CNC. You know what I mean? And that is partly because the host is a CNC shop. But yeah, that CNCs really have, and even in my time in the industry, I've been involved with the industry for 12 years now. I feel like even in those 12 years, like I remember back in the day when me knowing CAD was actually rare, or like that was interesting to know CAD. And now it's just you almost expect everyone coming in to just go straight to that.
Go straight to it, yeah.
Yeah, so
Which
it's
there's, I think there's pros and cons to that. I guess it's only based in my experience, right? But I'm very grateful that I had the experience of making knives before designing knives.
yes.
You were the one of the first that really bucked that at a high level. At least in what I've seen, and like in factory collaboration and the industry that I, the when you came in, especially, you were completely an outlier. Designing knives, but not making knives. That was crazy. I think you're right, it's much more common now. Right?
Yeah.
It was funny talking with Jens. We were like, just these different periods of time come up. Where we were like, man, do you remember like this guy, Joel Perella? Do you know Joel Perella? Do you know that name? So he was a knife designer. This would have been like early 2000s. And what he would do is he would basically design his style knife for a custom maker. And it was like, from what I remember, like 2D CAD, like almost like a Photoshop image. So it would be some maker with Joel Perella's like lines on it. And this was like a big deal. It was like a status thing to work with Joel Perella, all like a ton of big name makers. It's funny thinking about it back then, it would have been like Greg Lightfoot, Alan Alicious, like makers that were really popular, had a name. That was a collaboration type that doesn't really exist anymore.
No, that's interesting.
Yeah. You'll have to look it up. You'll see it instantly. You're like, oh, that's the style. And it's like Pat Crawford. I mean, everybody did it.
It's a little bit, I don't know the history, but it reminds me a little bit of the Dauntless knife,
Totally.
how it
Very
like,
similar kind of concept.
which I don't
And there's
know.
a Perella Dauntless. I guarantee it. There
Interesting.
has, maybe not. Maybe there's Perella Tads. Maybe there's not a Dauntless.
Yeah,
That's
that's an
interesting.
interesting. Yeah, that has not continued.
I never did it. For some reason, those never made sense to me. Right. But I think retro, like, or hindsight, I think in hindsight, what it illustrates is that at a level, especially at that time period, generating new design when you had product that was successful and you had your work and were not doing CAD and stuff was like difficult. So there was a lot of value in that type of collab. And I think the way it usually worked was like it might be makers might do a 10-piece run. I think Joel got one for his collection or something. And then there was, I don't know if it was that plus money, but you as a maker, the makers paid. They gave a percentage of this, right? Tashi, do you know Tashi
Barucha.
Barucha?
Yeah.
So he's really, really good dude, talented designer.
Yeah, he's
Like
legit.
works creatively outside of the knife industry too. He used to do the same thing. So a lot like early on, Tashi would do, he would give makers a design. It's such an, I wonder what changed and why that's not as common anymore. Right. Now it's more
Yeah.
like production collabs.
It's probably because the opportunity for production collaborations exploded and it
Yeah.
just hoovered up all the designs in a sense. You
Yeah.
know, it was like people, because it used to be production collaboration was such a small set of
So
slots
rare.
that, like, if you wanted a designer, that was what you really enjoyed and you wanted a made, the only way, like, it was you'd have to distribute it to knife makers that you knew, like, personally. Whereas now it's like there's so many companies wanting design work that it's like they just kind of grab everything that comes up. I don't know, maybe.
I wonder, these are the things like in small industries that are really interesting to me. Like, I would love for an economist to look at this and be like, here's the trajectory of knife collaborations inside of the industry, right? 'Cause I can kind of piece together some of it, right? So you have CRKT, obviously, as one of the first collaborators of scale, and that's what 30 plus years ago. Okay. You had Ken Onion really push it forward with Kershaw, right? You had Kit Carson with CRKT. These are like where things start to become like commonplace. But in the industry, like when I got my first collaboration, it was pretty rare. It was a big deal, right? And I don't know at that point, like how many companies were really doing it, right? You had some of the outliers, like outside of like the EDC, like tactical side, maybe would have been like Case and Tony Bowes, right? Now it's got to be 20X or something.
Now, like, I mean, a giant percentage of all knives are third-party design.
What is okay, that even still is new. What do you think that I would say, okay, that is the rise of Chinese like brands and OEM relationships. So is that within the last 10 years, 8 years?
Honestly, the brands I'm thinking about that really, really advanced the ball on this is like Kaiser is the one that was like a little bit earlier, and then we following behind them.
Kaiser, we,
And it
yep.
was kind of like that family that, you know,
Riot.
Riot, but Riot, I feel like they did a lot of that, but I feel like Kaiser is the one that really was like, we're going to do that model of almost everything we make is going to be a third party design.
Huh.
And then it feels like to me, I
Yeah,
definitely,
because we and Riot also do internal design. I guess Riot does more OEM. I think of them as more of an OEM or collaborator, I guess, in that sense.
And they do a lot of in-house. Like I remember back in the
Yeah.
day, almost everything was in-house.
Yeah.
And then, but Kaiser was out there doing like, because I just think about my, you know, comrades from that era, my other designer
Yeah.
friends. It was like Kaiser was kind of a lightning rod for like people designing, and then we came along. And yeah, that story of like the one of the things that they do well, the Chinese do really well, is that their ability to engineer new models at a high
Yeah.
rate.
Yeah.
So there's the production side that they can make a lot of things, but they can also engineer at a high
New
volume.
things. Yeah.
And so that opened the slots, because if you're traditionally, if you're a like a stateside company or a European company or something, like you're allowing designers to come in and help you, but your engineering output is not going to allow for enough SKUs to have like 50 slots, you know what I mean? And
Yeah.
so they came and they're like, okay, we're literally going to do dozens of designs every year with different collaborations and stuff. And that really changed the landscape, which is interesting, you know, created a lot of variability.
It really is. Here, something you just said triggered a thought, which is, who do you think of, like, who did you come up with? Right? Like, first 4 years, when you say like a designer you saw go somewhere else, like, are there guys that you think of as like you like a contemporary class of designer or maker that you kind of came up with?
As far as sadly Elijah Isham was
Yeah.
probably the most contemporary.
Yep. That makes
We were
absolute
exact same
sense.
age, exact same
Same
time.
age, same kind of trajectory, different. Man, super talented.
And
Bummer.
yeah, rest in peace. I don't know
Rest
if
in
people
peace.
know about him, but we should keep him in our minds.
Yep. Look
But
it up. Interesting story all around. Really, really interesting designer, especially for the knife industry.
So that was, that he was the most contemporary, because he also didn't make, he launched right into CAD.
Yeah, and he went into he went with we.
And he went with, so he, it was like I jumped on the older model of like going to like big box
Yeah,
production
established
factory
knife companies.
CRKT, you know,
Yep.
and he went on to the at that time brand new path, which was like, I'm gonna go to, you know, work with Wee and Kaiser as well.
Ironically, this, I mean, he was a point I've used him as an example many times over the years because he was one of the first designer grabs by a Chinese company. Because I don't think any established knife company at the when he started would have given him the time of day.
And
Because
he
his design wasn't refined in a certain way. It was wild conceptually. But his CAD skills weren't what your CAD skills are.
As far as I know, yeah, he was doing like 2D DXF. It was a draft
Yeah.
site.
Yeah. Draft site pieces, right? But I think where that worked was with we, they saw how his designs translated with their production capabilities.
And they were a power couple for sure. Like they,
Man.
yeah, that, th yeah, that was, they like caught lightning in a bottle with his kind of far-reaching wildness and
Yeah,
their,
insectoid designs like multi-piece, like really, really wild. Precursor, like when that stuff was out too, like now some of the stuff that CKF does, Custom Knife Factory, is it CKF's Custom Knife Factory? Yeah, the collabs they do with some of like the Russian designers, it ha they have that feel, right? These very like kind of angular, abstract shapes, inlays, overlays. But it was with his stuff, man, it was really standout.
Yeah, when you look, yeah, you'll never, if you've seen his stuff and you see it again, like you'll never question whose it was. You know what I
Yeah.
mean? There was no question. Yeah.
Who else? Anybody else?
Trying to think. Justin Lundquist is
Oh,
he,
yeah.
I feel like, I don't know exactly when he came in, but there was a similar,
There's some overlap
yeah,
there.
there's some that's close-ish. Yeah, I'm gonna have to think about that.
Yeah, kind of a
Yeah,
fun,
yeah.
because I think, and I'm like, oh, like the guys that I saw at every show, you know, and there's a handful of them where we're within a few years of age of each other, or the brands were close enough that like we were really tight. Kind of fun just to do an audit sometimes.
Yeah, for sure.
Can we talk about, you want to talk about your shop updates, or do we talk about Blade Show?
Let's do a quick shop update and then
Okay.
we'll go to Blade Show. So, yeah, we crazy month. I was in Indianapolis, Oklahoma City, Salt Lake City, basically back to back to back. And then
Oh.
so all great stuff, you know, had a really good time all across the board, but finally stabilized, you know, back in town, and that feels amazing. And our shop did okay. Dalton took a week off also for hunting in there, which is awesome. So, I mean, going into September, I mean, I knew before September, I was like, this month is going to be like a train wreck. It actually turned out better than I would have expected. It was, we like survived it without too much damage incurred. And so now we're kind of, I was telling you before the pod, the main thing is we kind of got behind on, we have to feed our supply chain. So we have to like, keep steel coming, keep it going to water jet, keep it going to surface grinding, keep knives going to heat treat. And so a big part of like keeping our train on the tracks is having, well, I don't know if it's a real phrase, but I call it like supply chain saturation, which is that
So you
like,
want to be saturated, essentially. Like you don't,
yeah,
yeah.
and not too much, but like you want to have a couple layers going to each thing so that you don't end up with like a stalled business because of one single, you know, weak link.
Right.
And so we're kind of stalled now a little bit in a couple categories, but we kind of rushed this week to kind of, okay, we need to get something to heat treat. I got to move this stuff to surface grinding. And so next week we should start to see a return to normal. But none of this is like unplanned. This is, I just, we're just going to take this month or September. We're just going to take it in stride and just move through it as best we
Yeah.
can. And it did okay. But the funny thing is, I get back, I'm like, okay, we need to get back to nominal standard processing. Like it's time to rock and roll again. Sit
Yeah.
down first thing Monday morning, first Monday back, first email on the top of the list. They're like, your X9 is almost here. I'm like,
Oh, man.
okay. It's what's the procedure? Yep. Which implies moving all of our machines around.
Yeah. Not level. It's like
Yeah. So the only thing about that, I'm really excited. This is huge. I'm really excited for this. But they there was that port strike
Yeah.
and it apparently has resolved, but now there's a huge backlog with like actually getting
Right.
stuff in and
Yeah.
out.
Bottleneck.
Yeah. And so there's a huge vagueness on the timeline because of that. And so it's like they're like, it could be 10 days or it could be like a month. But I don't know. And
Okay.
so I was like, well, I'm going to face the possible like short-term contingent. So I'm going to make sure all the financing's locked in, everything's ready to go.
Yeah.
So that was kind of this week is like on the margins, like getting quotes, making sure everything's dialed in, you know, had like ABC, these are where I'm going to look into for the financing. So I've got that done now.
So that wasn't all locked in ahead of time?
No, so basically the way it works is when you want the machine to have some attribute that is not like standard, which I wanted through spindle coolant, you have to put
Okay.
10% down to have the machine built
Yeah.
because they won't build a custom configuration without 10%.
Sure.
But they told me, they're like, this is a new machine that hasn't even been to North America yet. So they're like, I mean, if I couldn't really get a financing agreement, I gave them the 10% down like 8 months
Oh,
ago.
yeah.
So it's like, if I had financed it 8 months ago, then that would have been
Right.
problematic. So
Yeah.
I was just like, I basically secured the machine with the 10%.
Okay.
And then it's like, I don't even get the final invoice until it lands in Houston, which is their warehouse.
Right.
And then the
Okay.
invoice gets paid. So, and that's the way it worked with the X.
So with this, break it down for us a little bit as far as like machine financing. So it's not internal financing, like you're not going through Sile for financing. So what is the best option that you found for
This is a
financing a
great
machine?
conversation. I'm glad you asked. Honestly, there's a lot of meat here because I just talked to a bunch of people, banks and stuff.
Nice.
So that we're in a world of interest rates that aren't as ideal as what they were some time ago.
It's an understatement. Yep.
So I went into it knowing that, but I actually felt like I came out better than I expected. So the thing about machines is you can get a conventional loan from like a conventional lender, like a credit union or something. And you could even look into the SBA stuff. Interest rate. So I talked to a credit union here in Idaho who I banked with for like 10 years. They basically told me, not even having run my credit, they just said, okay, this type of machine, this is what the range of APR is going to be, like no matter who you are. And it was going to be like 12 or 13%.
Oof.
And so I was like, ooh, I don't even want to really go down that path because they also said they basically treat it like a mortgage. So they're like, we need 2 years of tax returns. We need, profit and loss year to date. We need balance sheet year to date. We
Yeah,
need,
yeah.
they, ba it was literally the same list that I saw when we tried to get a mortgage, which sucks. It's like a
It's
total,
so much.
it's a pat
Yeah.
down. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And so I was like, okay, I don't love that. So there's a company called Geneva Capital.
Yep.
They are a partner with Tormach because they are the
Oh.
not in-house, but they're like the adjunct
Yeah.
financer. Sile picked them up too. So if you go to Sile's
Oh.
website, Geneva is on there. They have an interesting, I used to, I financed through them on my Tormach, but the reason I did it is because my Tormach was repossessed by them. And then I bought it from Geneva, which is a weird situation.
Yeah, it's like
And
buying a
so,
car that was repoed
yeah, you're buying it like from the
almost.
bank itself.
Yeah.
So it was really kind of almost default that you're going to finance it through the company that you're
Yeah,
buying it
yeah,
from.
yeah.
So I didn't really shop that much when I got the Tormach and their terms were good enough. So I wasn't really planning on circling back to them because this is a different type of situation. I assumed that I would get better rates at like a bank. So I talked to them again. I'm like, okay, this is a different machine. I'm not buying it from you guys. I just want to see your numbers. The way that they do things is it's actually a lease. So it's a lease to own. And
Yeah.
the only reason that it is called that or that is written that way is because it has huge implications legally. And
Okay.
so basically they have way stronger repossession rights if it's a lease than if it's like
Okay.
a
Makes
finance,
sense.
like a
Yeah.
conventional loan, because they don't like a CNC machine doesn't have a title.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's not, and you can't like pull up with a tow truck and run off with
Yeah.
it. And so it's like they lease it to you, which is might be, I don't know this for a fact. It m could be similar to how Haas does it, where
I would imagine. I'm thinking that's how it was when I did my Kayser, like a very similar, like a lease. Yeah.
So the beauty of that is because they have it's like a pro and con. It's like they have so much control over the
Yeah.
repossession possibility that they are way more lax on the turn on what they need to see from you. So
Right.
all they ask for, and I had the history of having a machine with them prior, but all they ask for is like we need 3 months of bank statements. That's it.
Yeah.
They don't care about your taxes. They don't care about your income. They don't care
That's
about. They're
wild.
like, I they just like, I just want to see 3 months of cash flow and we're just gonna make a call on it. That's like, and they do run your credit obviously, but
Sure.
it's like way more cowboy. It's way more like they just want to look at it and somebody's making a a call on
A
like
judgment
they're big
call.
enough to handle this based on
That
their cash
sounds
flow.
like Haas and it sounds like Harley. Like where you kind of go in and they're like, oh yeah, no, we can put you in a machine or on a motorcycle. What, oh, you, yeah, okay, no, man, you're good. Like, I, that's the vibe.
I mean, I sent them over the 3 months thing, and it was like the next morning. They're like, "Yeah, we got you. You're good." So, but the crazy thing is, I thought their rates were going to be higher because of the situation with the lease and
Sure.
stuff. They were lower by low enough that I don't know if it's possible for me to get a lower rate anywhere else, unless it was some sort of like federally backed, like SBA or
Are you
something.
gonna hold out on the rate?
10.5,
Okay. That's
which
yeah,
is,
it's like not great, but it's way better than what else you're seeing.
well, and in this modern situation for a
Yeah.
business machine loan,
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love to hear input if anyone's out there. Like, throw all our rates out in the air so
Yeah.
everyone can see them. But I mean, I was expecting 10%. Like, I was just thinking, like, this is
Yeah.
car loans are 6% now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these are more than cars.
Yeah,
They are
I
going,
would love to hear that as well. You know, and that's like another like thinking about Haas. Haas is internal financing, so they can do things like, oh, cool, yeah, 18 months, 0%. We're doing a Christmas sale. There's different when weighing machine purchases, there's definite input that can sway the decision.
And I wonder if those Haas, because like Geneva, they call it a finance agreement,
Yeah.
but it's a little bit of like legalese, because
Yeah.
it's not a
Literally at least,
loan,
yeah.
it's a lease. I
Yeah.
wonder if Haas, that's the way it is, and they just
I
call it a
bet.
finance agreement,
Yeah, I bet.
because the way they have, like how Haas, they can shut your machine down if you don't pay. They can literally remotely like turn it off. That sounds like it might be a lease.
I
You
bet
know what I
whatever
mean?
that structure is accurate. I actually just heard the first time, like I had always heard with Haas, like they will finance anyone. And recently, a friend reached out to Haas, but he doesn't have a business history. Financially fine. He's like a machinist and designer, but had been working for a company or is working for a company and was like trying to buy the machine based on his salary, which is far like sufficient to do the to make the purchase. But they wouldn't finance him without 3 years of business records. And so maybe the caveat there is Haas will finance you if you are a business that has been in business for a little while. And that's why, like, as a blind spot, I wouldn't see that because everybody that I knew that was buying
Was
one had
already in
been in
business.
business for a while. So that
If you're a startup.
if you're a startup, so he went with a Sile
He probably
because
went with Geneva.
they would finance him. And that was so he even wanted to go with a Haas and he was super frustrated. He's also very happy with the Sile. So
That's great.
yeah.
And so that's a good point, because I did use Geneva when I got my Tormach,
Yeah.
and I had a business, but it was not a manufacturing business. You know what
Right.
I mean? So it was like I mean, they are very fluid and like easy to work with.
Yeah.
If you want a machine, like, seems like they will make it happen. And
Good. That is
so,
good info.
and they will do any machine. Like, they're partners with them. But I remember when I bought the Tormach, he was like, "Yeah, just so you know, you ever buy another machine, like anything used, whatever."
It's good to know.
So, and all kinds of, like I said, you give away your position a little bit because you're allowing
Sure.
them to lease it to you.
Yeah.
But if you know you can make the payment in doing that, you're giving them the security to be able to be way more flexible with you.
Yeah.
Because like I said, you go to a bank and it's like they're looking at you like you're borrowing for a, rental house in
Yeah.
a floodplain. You know,
Yeah.
it's like
Yeah, it's
they,
un yeah, it's unfamiliar.
So,
Sweet.
but
Okay.
so that machine's gonna get here and it's gonna blow up. I mean, I was talking to Dalton, like, the whole shop is gonna completely turn upside down when that gets here. Nothing will be the same after that
Oh,
thing
wow.
arrives. It'll like there's nothing that could really, I could imagine changing things more. And the reason is we're going to use it to grind bevels,
Right.
and we do everything pre-heat treat,
Yeah.
including the bevel.
Yeah.
So we're now going to be machining and then going to heat treat and then doing bevels, which is a completely different
Yep.
flow.
Yep.
And that, it sounds minor, but it's like sending it to heat treat and it goes back onto a machine for a second time.
Yep.
But the first operation is now a tiny fraction of the cycle time. So it's like
Yeah.
that the pressure is going to be, we're going to want to do way more volume at once to
Yeah.
heat treat
Yeah.
and then probably segment it with the grinding.
Yeah.
And that changes everything. Like, I think our whole schedule is going to completely change. So I don't know how that's going to fall, but
Super.
it'll be
It's
interesting.
so funny, man. The hard milling versus soft milling thing. I just think it's like my super knifey background. I love the idea of hard milling, right? Or hard grinding. It just suits because for, I don't know what, 15 years I've been grinding my blades on folders in the hardened state, and it's like
Seems
dimensionally
natural.
stable. It seems, yeah, it seems like the natural progression. So that's cool.
It's I'm excited for it. It's the biggest thing is we stone bevels
Yeah.
because they're milled. If you want it to look really smooth, like it was ground, you have to stone it. We want to aim to go as little to zero stoning as we possibly can with this
Yeah.
system.
Yeah.
And the amount of time that Dalton spends stoning that could be reversed is like, I mean, it's just huge. It's everything. It's like the single biggest, most important thing we could do.
That's amazing.
And I've known that for like 3 years since we started, but we couldn't fit a machine like this in our garage.
Yep.
And literally, like the day that I got this lease for this shop, I ordered
Yeah.
this machine.
I remember.
And
Yeah.
so I'm glad it didn't immediately show up because, to be honest, we like my time was way too thin
Yeah.
to get this thing. So it's actually, I'm liking the timing a little bit.
Yeah. How what start to delivery, what were with even though it's not there, what were we looking at? When did you order it?
Had to have been, I'd have to look at a date. It had to have been March
Okay.
or April. And that's not normal. That's because this is the X9, which is not,
New,
it's not been
right?
delivered at all. Like
Yeah.
it's, it was like a prototype when I ordered it. So,
Do you have one of the first to hit soil, or like was
I
it?
believe they've landed a few in
Okay.
other international markets
Yeah.
and like a few. And then this is theoretically the very first batch coming to North America.
Okay.
So it's not the first batch, first to this hemisphere, probably.
Dude,
Yeah.
super exciting.
So I'm gonna definitely do some YouTube, but it's a little intimidating with how heavy it is. I mean,
Yeah. How heavy is
because
it?
14,000 pounds.
That's a big machine.
Yeah,
Wow.
but it's not big.
No, it's
It's
just a lot of
small, but it
mass.
weighs
Yeah.
that much. So it's kind of freaky actually, but the only thing I worry about is the size of the forklift, because I was talking to the rigging company when they were here last time, and I was like, okay, if I have a 14,000 pound machine show up, like, how do you handle that? And they're like, well, we have to use, if we go to that weight, they have to use their like 30,000, 20,000 pound
Yeah.
forklift. Like they have
Yeah.
like one that's 10 times the size of the smaller one that they use for
Yeah.
the X7. And so I'm like, well, I hope they don't put like ruts in our concrete floor,
No
you know what I
kidding.
mean? But it'll work out, it's
Sweet,
whatever.
man. Should we do like a quick blade
Yeah,
update?
sure.
Like give us a post show?
I love Blade Show West. I think for some people it's not the best show. For us, it is the best. Maybe not the best of all, but like for, if you include the drivability that we can go
Yep.
down to it, if you include the demographic that's there, we got a lot of outdoorsmen. There's a lot of casual knife buyers, people that gravitate more towards our brand up here at Blade Show West, more so than Atlanta, I think.
Yeah.
And so we felt really good there, met a lot of really cool people, talked to Jens, hung out with the Tactile guys, hung out with, Big Idea Design, Ben at
Nice.
NAFS. We had a little after party at NAFS. That was fun. Hung out with the guys from our shop here, you know, took Ronnie and Dalton down. Just a good time. I mean, really relaxing because last year was our first ever exhibit of any kind. And so Blade Show West being drivable was an easy show technically, but because it was our first, it was like pretty anxiety inducing. But this year was like, we now have Blade West and Atlanta under our belt. Now we're coming back to Blade West. It's like the most relaxed I've been so far. It was very easy, I guess you
I
would
love
say.
it. We were talking about this a little bit, and so the distinction, I think, of why this show is like a very good fit for you is what you just mentioned around the casual buyer. So a lot of shows that's really heavily dependent on like super enthusiast, you know, collectors. Salt Lake has a high proportion of people who like probably are seeing a knife show advertised and are like, oh, a knife show. Sweet. I'm gonna go check it out. Your product suits not necessarily that buyer as a whole, but because of, I think, the natural buyer maybe in Salt Lake that's interested in knives, it's like a perfect fit. Your knife's not $1,000 and you don't have to lottery in to get one. They can look at it, see that it's super cool, talk to you, see that you're essentially a neighbor, and make like a pretty easy decision to leave with something. That I think is like strategy around, in your case with this right now, unintentionally dialing in the product for a location, right? It just naturally works for you.
It aligns with our brand vision as far as the demographic and the scene of like just the it's the Rocky Mountains, it's an elk hunting state, it's you know, it's just the type of it's close to Moab. Like we make Overland knives, you know what I mean? It aligns. Whereas Atlanta, I love Atlanta, I love going, but it's more EDC. Rarity is more important. Uniqueness is more important. Like exclusivity is more important down there, in general. And so it's like it's just not how we operate. You know what I mean? So it's Blade West is just a good home for us. It's really
And
good.
it's drivable. I told you, I kind of feel like at this point, Blade West is probably should be on my list just because it's a real show that's drivable. And I say real show like as a convention show, right? And I think there's a lot of value in that, you know? So might add it for next year. We'll see
Definitely
if
come
I can
down.
make more Kihokus.
Do it.
Sweet. You and I have a lot of catching up to do after pod, probably soon in the next week or something. But should we, do you think we should wrap this one? And
Yeah,
okay.
that was a lot of information.
We
Talking about
get bottled
machine
up.
financing and shows and bevel grinding and surface grinders breaking.
Dude, oh man, machines going down is like the worst thing. And like these are simple machines with fairly simple solutions.
That's another point why I'm excited for the X9. I look at this X7 almost every week. I'm like, please don't break.
Please don't break.
Because it's the beating heart, and the X9 could replace the X7 instantly. I would have to buy more tool holders, but it would do exactly the same thing.
As a
And so
backup, you have it.
it's a backup. So it's like,
I'm getting the
you
same
know.
place with the Haas where I'm realizing, wow, the numbers that I'm starting to push into or the consistency could be a problem for simple machines. It could also be a problem for my older CNC machine. So hopefully the overlap like allows me to get a new machine soon.
Right.
Sweet. Guys, thank
Cool.
you for listening. If you're in the Patreon, thank you. Drop us some questions. Go talk finance in there because we're curious if you guys are
Yeah,
coming up with different solutions.
anybody that doesn't care, throw rates around, either that you've been quoted or that you have heard people talk about. Like I haven't agreed to that deal yet, so if something else is out there or if someone else is looking, tell us.
Do it. All right. Be well.
Peace.